All right. Back to the book of Exodus. As I just suggested, we're studying Moses, but in the last few chapters, and particularly the next couple of chapters, it's really more about the people of Israel than anything else. And but, you know, we sort of learn a little bit about Moses, even with regard to his leadership, as you think about these Israelites. And the reason for that simply is because the Israelites were not an easy people to lead. They had a lot of difficulties with their character, and that is true as a whole. Now I know that no doubt some of the individual Israelites probably weren't as bad as some others with regard to some of the characteristics that we see, but even in the narrative, most of the things are attributed to the whole group, and it is true that as a whole, just generally speaking, they had some characteristics that would make it hard for a leader to guide them. And so it just tells us that really Moses did a very good job dealing with these people. We'll see in the next couple of chapters the overriding sin of the people. Number one, they complain and grumble all the time, they're murmuring all the time. And that in itself was sinful. Because it really stemmed from other things like their lack of faith and their lack of faithfulness. They were a stubborn people, and so all of these things. And again, I'm not saying that each and every one of them. Remember, we're now talking about over 2 million people, and I'm not saying that every one of them had the same degree of negativity with regard to these things, But it is attributed to the whole congregation, the ESV says. And so that's what Moses was up against. Now remember, if you were here last week, we talked about those cycles that the Israelites went through over and over again. We really, even today sometimes, go through these cycles. And so if you weren't here, it all begins, first of all, with being blessed in some form or fashion by God, having some kind of abundance that God has blessed his people with, which is something God does over and over again. He blesses us all the time. I think we would all agree with that. And sometimes that blessing, as good as that is and as thankful as we should be, sometimes it can lead to some unrealistic expectations. And that's the second cycle. It begins with God blessing his people, and then they develop an expectation that's just not realistic. Nothing wrong with having expectation, particularly with regard to the promises of God. That's what we call hope. Remember, hope is desire and confident expectation. But sometimes we can develop, when God blesses us, an unrealistic expectation, and that's what the Israelites were doing. They thought the Red Sea experience and how that they were delivered, everything was good, their enemies were destroyed. Now everything was just going to be smooth sailing for now on, and that wasn't realistic. It's not realistic for us when we obey the gospel and think now there's not going to be any problems in life. Everything is just going to be rosy and no trials or tribulations or anything like that. That's not realistic. Nor is it realistic for us to think that God is going to give us everything we want all the time. He'll provide for our needs, but he's not going to always give us everything we want. And there are some who have obeyed the gospel over the years that have had expectations like that, and they end up quitting because they feel like Christianity isn't what they thought it would be. And that all goes back to having unrealistic expectation. The third cycle then is disappointment. When you have those expectations that aren't based really on any promise that God has given and they're unrealistic, then you become disappointed and distraught over the things that you are now experiencing. And so that can lead to, again, despair, a gloom and doom kind of attitude. And that's not good for anyone. And then the fourth cycle, then, after someone has that kind of mentality and is disappointed, sooner or later they begin to do what the Israelites did. They murmur and start complaining. And that's, again, just no good. And that demonstrates a lack of appreciation when you're complaining all the time. We'll see in these next couple of chapters. That was what the Israelites did more than anything else when things didn't go their way. Like, we've already seen that. We've seen it twice, if you count their complaining even or their murmuring at the Red Sea. And then, of course, when the water was bitter, and we're going to see it as we get into chapter 16 with the lack of food, they're going to begin complaining. But as we go forward, throughout their wandering the wilderness, that seems to be what they do first. Whenever there's any kind of crisis, any kind of trouble, they just start complaining. And so that's that fourth cycle, and we want to avoid that. All of these things are things we can learn from, because we're the people of God today. And we don't want to have any of these things. We don't want to have unrealistic expectations. We don't want to live with a gloom and doom kind of attitude because we're disappointed about Christianity. And we certainly don't want to be complainers. There are complainers in the church. There always have been. I suppose we all have complained about this or that, but we don't want to be like the Israelites, chronic complainers. And so those are the cycles. And then we saw at the end, the fifth one is that God actually blessed them. Even in that state of complaining, God blessed them. And it just shows that God is a merciful and maybe even a better word, he is a patient God. And we're going to see that again in chapter 16, that right in the midst of their complaining, God blesses them. That's God's response to them. And it doesn't mean at all that God isn't angry with them, that he is. And one thing we want to point out to make sure we don't make the mistake of thinking is that the patience of God is never going to run out. That even though God with the Israelites, he kind of ignores their murmuring at this time and gives them, you know, provides for them. But, again, they do that so often that we're going to find in the future he just gets tired of it. And, you know, we'll find him asking Moses, how long am I going to have to put up with this? And, in fact, on a couple of occasions, he concluded that he was just going to destroy them. And if it wasn't for the interceding of Moses, he probably would have. And so we want to, let's make sure we understand. We still, you know, just think of how patient God is with us. He is just a patient God, always has been, and that's just his nature. But we don't want to take advantage of that or think that we are. You know, just we better realize that sometimes his patience runs out. Well, all right, as we look at Exodus 16 then, it says at verse 1, and they set out from Elim, and all of the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. That word sin there is related to Sinai. Doesn't have anything to do with the theological term sin or whatever. I think we know that. But just that part of the wilderness that they came to, he says it is between Elim and Sinai on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. So just keep in mind here that basically they've only been removed from their exodus, from their leaving of Egypt for about a month. Like, that's really amazing when you think about their reaction to things that are going on with them. I mean, it was just a month before this that they were partaking of the Passover for the first time back in Egypt. And just a short period of time has passed. And so sort of keep that in mind. It makes their reaction to things even that much more worse. It says that the people, it says, and the people of Israel grumbled against Moses in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, would that he had died by the hand of, that we rather would have died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Now, you just stop and think about this and their reaction to this. First of all, they're clearly overreacting to their situation. And I'm not belittling the situation that they're in. They are in a situation where the only way they're going to survive is if God intervenes. Because they're in the wilderness. Remember, they're 2 million strong. Some say even closer to 3 million. So there's a whole lot of people here. And there isn't any natural resource for them to get food. They have no relationship with anybody in the wilderness or anything like that they can bargain with or anything. They're in trouble. They need the help of God. And it could very well be they're looking at the situation and realizing, you know, we're in trouble. But again, it demonstrates a lack of faith, because God hasn't left them. God's still with them, and they should know that. But instead, they complain and they complain to about Moses or to Moses and Aaron, and really, you know, you just stop and think about that. How cruel that is. For them to turn on Moses. I mean, Moses has been nothing but good to these people. Think of the sacrifice Moses has made for them and everything that he has done. But they just turn on him and attribute to him something that is ridiculous. When you think about that, just listen to these words again. Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots. The Hebrew there really points to the idea of pots full of meat, and ate bread to the full. So not only are they responding to Moses in a cruel way, but they're exaggerating their past. Like, I mean, they're thinking about Egypt like, boy, we had it great in Egypt. You know, we had pots full of meat and everything we wanted. It was great in Egypt. But look, it wasn't that long ago, back in Exodus chapter 2. You remember, way back even before the plagues and all of that, in the second chapter at verse 23, it says, during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. So now you think back there. What situation were they in? They were groaning. They were crying out to God because of their slavery. But now, oh, how wonderful it was back in Egypt. We were sitting next to pots of meat. And you, Moses, changed everything. You brought us out here. And then they say to Moses that you brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Like, that was just really, why? That was stupidity is what that was. How in the world would you conclude that Moses, after everything he's done for them, that he purposely led them out into the wilderness to kill them? It makes no sense at all. But again, they have no faith in God. They are distraught. They're in this state of disappointment. So they're complaining. They're not even thinking straight. And so they're attributing to Moses something that is ridiculous. And Moses is going to point out, by the way, anything that you say, you need to realize it's not me. It's really God, because it wasn't Moses. He was just the physical leader, but they were led to where they are by God. He's the one in charge, and Moses is not going to let that go by without mentioning that to him. So he's going to bring that out to them. But here they are, all of this complaining. And again, when you stop and think about complaining, it always comes about, first of all, because of a lack of thankfulness. And, I mean, whenever we complain, particularly if we complain it's related to God at all, are we forgetting how blessed we are as a people? God has blessed them, the Israelites, greatly. They've just been delivered from Egyptian bondage. And they're showing a lack of faith. They don't believe in the power of God. As I said a few moments ago, they're going to need God's help to survive in the wilderness. But do they think God's not capable? Like they've already seen the power of God firsthand. They know He's a supernatural God. They saw all of the plagues. They saw the opening of the Red Sea. If they need food, even if it has to be miraculously delivered, why would they think God couldn't do it? But they have no faith in that. They have no faith in the provision of God. When you think about it, they have no faith that God cares and is concerned for them. They don't even have faith in the goodness of God. They think they've been completely abandoned here. And there's no basis for that at all. And sometimes today, we can start feeling the same way when things don't go our way, when trials and tribulations come. We can start feeling as if somehow God has forsaken us. God has abandoned us. Is there any basis for that? No, never. God cares for us, and we should know that. We should never doubt the goodness of God, no matter what comes along in our life. And so we want to be very careful that we don't respond to the different crisis that may come into our life the way the people of God did back then. Remember what I said last week? This is kind of our wilderness wandering, this life now. We're heading towards Canaan, but we're not there yet. And you just think about those, the children of Israel, did they make it into the land of Canaan? That generation, the adults at least, no, they did not. They did not. Nor will we if we develop the kind of mentality that they had. Are you a complainer? Do you complain all the time? Do you have faith in God that He's going to take care of you, that He can deliver you from whatever problems come into your life? Or do you just complain about the state that you're in? We need to think about that. Again, these things were written for our learning. And so all they do is complain. But look at verse 4 then. Here's God's response. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not." And so in the next several verses, verse 4 going down to, I guess, about verse 15 or so, all of that is God making a promise to the people. In His mercy, in His kindness, here they are complaining. God doesn't really call them on that. He just gives them a promise. He is going to provide for them. All they have to do is accept, believe, and trust the promise of God. And we need to trust the promises of God today. God is a God of promise. Think of all the promises that He has made. And we could be sure they're all going to come to fruition. But we have to have faith. We have to have trust in God. And that trust, faith, is the answer to everything from a spiritual standpoint. It helps us to overcome the idea of being distraught or in despair. It helps us make it through the trials and tribulations of life if we trust that God hasn't left us and He's going to help us with His providential care. We have to trust that. The book of Psalms is great. We don't have time, but turn over to Psalms 28. Someone read Psalms 28 at verse 7. The psalmist is great at just talking about trust and faith in God. Just over and over he talks about that. But someone read that verse. Psalms 28, verse 7.
The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusted in Him, and I am helped. Therefore, my heart greatly rejoices.
great. And so my strength, he's my strength, the psalmist said, my shield, my heart trust, and I'm helped. Who are the ones who are helped even today? Those who really trust in God. And you get out of concordance. You can look. There's so many different of the psalms that talk about trust. The ESV a lot of times will talk about the Lord being our refuge. And that's right. He's the one we can turn to in difficult times. He is our place of safety. He is our strength. He is our shield. But there's a whole lot of psalms that use that kind of language, because in real life, that's what it's about, trusting in God. Like when you let's go back over to Exodus, but when you think about what's going on with the Israelites, this is a real life happening. As I said, I'm not going to belittle the situation that they're in. Like it's easy for us to read this and think about the Israelites and what they should have done. And there's definite steps that they should have taken. And if they had more faith, they would have. But would we have? If we're in their situation, you're in the wilderness with from the human eye, no prospect of getting food, and your supply is running short quickly. What would you do in that situation? And again, we should have faith and trust that God is somehow going to provide for us. But listen, do we have faith in that even today all the time? When your supply runs low, when you get laid off from your job, or whatever the situation might be, your bills get a little bit high, and you start living from week to week, and whatever. Do you believe God is going to take care of you? Do you trust that? Remember Philippians 4 at verse 19, Paul told the brethren at Philippi, my God shall supply all your need. Do you believe that? If not, we have no business criticizing the Israelites and their real life situation where they actually needed a miracle. We don't need a miracle to survive. We can lean and trust in the providential care of God, as long as we seek him first. Remember Matthew 6 at verse 33. The Israelites, they were in a situation where they were not going to survive if God wasn't merciful enough to intervene. And what we have in these verses, we'll not read all of these verses in Exodus. What we have is God promising them he's going to intervene. He's going to rain bread down from heaven. What do they call it? Manna. And that's going to be the food that they eat along with the meat. He's going to cause quail to come into the camp to such the extent that they're easily caught and fed on. And that's going to be their diet for a long time. They're going to eat this manna throughout the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And they're going to complain even about that. And that's just, you know, sometimes God can make provision for us. We're not happy. Why? Because we're not satisfied. We want God not only to supply our need, but we want him to go beyond and give us what we want. And so we have to be even careful about that, not being content, as Paul said again in the book of Philippians. But he is going to provide for him. But look at verse 4, Exodus 16 at verse 4. There's a reason for all of this. God is without question demonstrating mercy. He loves his people. He cares for them. He's not going to let them perish in the wilderness. That was never the game plan. He was always going to take care of them. And so he's going to provide what they need, the food that they need to survive. But there's a reason other than just helping them survive physically. He tells them at verse 4 again, behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. So even giving them the manna and the quail, that was a test. And he was going to see how they would respond to that. And you notice, as you drop down a little bit, you go down to verse 13, we start getting the details of how this is all going to work out. And there are some rules they're going to have to keep. And so verse 13 says, in the evening, quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew laid around the camp. Verse 15. Let's drop down a little bit more there. It says, and when the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? That is the manna. And they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord had given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. This is the verse that I really wanted. Verse 16. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as you can. You shall each take an omer according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. And so there's all kind of lessons with regard to this manna. Here's one thing. This is no doubt a gracious, merciful act by God. He's blessing them. They don't deserve it. It is a matter of grace. But they still have to do something, don't they? And there's rules involved in this. And there's reason behind it. They're going to have to go out every morning and gather up some more manna. Which, when you stop and think about it, means they're going to have to trust. Here's the people kind of struggling with a trust issue. They're going to have to trust that each new day God will supply. Each new day, there'll be new manna. You can't keep it over. What happens if they don't eat it that day? It's going to spoil. It's going to spoil. And so God, this again, God's doing all of this on purpose. Remember, he's testing them. And some of them didn't do great with how they responded to all of this. It says in verse 17, and the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more and some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over. And whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. This is a passage, by the way, that Paul quoted with regard to giving in 2 Corinthians. He used this principle of, in other words, they were going to share with each other. If some, no matter what, that none of them would have too much and none of them would have too little, because they would cooperate and share. And Paul uses that in 2 Corinthians. But Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over until the morning. But what? They did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Like little simple things. This is why God's testing them. He's blessing them. He's not asking them to do anything great. Just a little thing. And some of them failed, didn't they? And I don't know why they some of them did that, didn't obey that little simple command, but some of them didn't listen, it says. They left part of it till the morning. Can you think of any motive why you might leave some of it for the morning? What wouldn't you have to do the next morning if you had some left over that night? Right, work. You wouldn't have to go out and gather anymore. Like, can you picture one of those Israelites who did that, said, you know, look at that. I still have plenty of manna left. I don't have to trust anybody. Tomorrow I'm going to eat that stuff. No, it's a lack of faith. It spoiled. But that's something little, a little simple thing. God gives us commands to keep. And you know, I'm convinced that we do better with some of the hardest, most difficult commands than we do the little everyday life stuff. But God demands that we keep his word completely. And that's what he is teaching these Israelites. Yeah, go ahead, Jesse.
I was just going to say with talking about that guy who leaves some up there, you think after a couple times you learn.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I can't keep this.
Right. I don't know that they did it twice even, but yeah, but that's right. But, you know, why even the first time? Moses was angry because of that, because it's a simple thing. But they didn't listen. Do we always listen to God? Like again, there are commandments that are very difficult. You know, love your enemy. That's not the easiest thing to do, is it? Remember Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount? These love even the one who persecutes you, says terrible things about you. How do you do if you hear someone speaking in a negative way about you? Someone on the job or something like that. Maybe even someone in the church saying something negative about you. How do you respond? I know how brethren have responded. And Jesus said, love them. That's one of those difficult commands. What about everyday things? What about something simple like, don't forsake the assembly? How hard is that? Sometimes we struggle with the simple ones. And as we go through this again, he says on verse 22, he says, and on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all of the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will, and boil what you will boil. And all that is left over, lay aside to be kept until the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink. And there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you should gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, now watch, on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. Like, really? Which one of the Israelites did that? I mean, just a simple, simple command. But some of them went out anyway. Yeah, right. Like some people, it's true in the church. Some just don't listen. Won't pay attention to God. Refuse to do what he says to do. Now remember back in verse 4, all of this is a test. Someone go over before the next bell ring. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 3. Someone read that for me. Deuteronomy 8:3. Interesting, isn't it? I know you're familiar with that passage. Jesus, of course, quoted it when he was tempted of the devil in Matthew chapter 4. We're all familiar with that. But now you can make the connection. But, you know, he is referring to what God did in Exodus 16. Now we know. You remember, again, he said he's testing them. He's teaching them what? You don't live by bread alone. Yeah, I'm going to give you manna, but this is what you have to do. This is how you have to do it. It's how you have to gather it. This is when you have to gather it. This is how much. All of that. He was seeing, are you going to obey my words or not? Are you going to do exactly what I tell you to do or not? And this is something they have to learn because throughout their history, this is never going to change. It never has changed with the people of God. Will we do what God says? Will we follow his word precisely or not? That's all there is to it. Remember, we're kind of wandering in the wilderness right now. He's testing us. Will we obey God, even in the little things, or not? We don't live by bread alone. By the way, we probably don't have time to develop this now, but when you think of manna, that manna was a type of Christ. And we know that because in John chapter 6, Jesus makes the application of that. Let's turn over there, see if we can fit this in. real fast. But there are all kind of types and anti-types in the Bible, and there are some types that some things we call types in the Bible that aren't really said to be types. Most scholars refer to them as inferred types, and there's a lot of those. But then there are some things that we know they're types because they're applied in the New Testament. And here in John chapter 6, down at verse 22, it says, "And on the next day, the crowd that remained on the other side of the sea saw that there had been only one boat there, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but his disciples had gone away alone. Other boats from Tiberias came near the place where they had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. So when the crowd saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they themselves got into the boat and went to Capernaum seeking Jesus. When they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, 'Rabbi, where did you come? Or when did you come here?' And Jesus answered them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you. For on him God the Father has set his seal.' Then they said to him, 'What must we do to do the works of God?' Jesus said to them, 'This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom you have sent.' So they said to him, 'Then what sign do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform?' 'Our fathers ate manna in the wilderness, as it is written, 'He gave them bread from heaven to eat.'" Now, obviously, I ran out of time here, so we'll pick up and finish that next week. But they're asking Jesus to duplicate that sign. And this is where Jesus gets in and starts telling them, "Well, yeah, but I'm the bread of life." And they didn't like that at all. And so we'll see. We'll look at that and see how that relates. The Jews there complained a whole lot and murmured, just like they did back in Exodus. So we'll talk about that.